the video and get that stuff out of the way, or is that easier?
Okay.
Is somebody else taping, or are you also trying to?
No, somebody else taping.
Okay. So I guess we'll go ahead and roll the tape. So thanks. My name is Joe Jordan. I live in Santa Cruz, California. I'm going to be leaving on the later bus today. I've been working at NASA Ames Research Center for 20 plus years and about to do a major career switch into teaching public high school math and physics. Physics for freshmen, kind of an interesting thing. Stuff I've been studying at NASA Ames involves a lot of atmospheric science having to do with the ozone layer in the polar stratosphere and the problem of global climate change, the greenhouse effect, global warming. And those are problems, and we've been studying them a lot, and a lot of other people, including a fellow who just came in to the village yesterday as an expert on that, works up at NOAA, National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, up in Ann Arbor.
Up here.
And I've been getting to the point where I'm feeling like we've got enough evidence that there's a serious problem afoot, which I didn't say this the other day, but unlike the ozone hole problem, which it's going to take a century for the atmosphere to heal itself, and we're on our way to doing that by having curbed the offending chemicals. And it sounds like a long time that it's going to be another 100 years till the atmosphere gets kind of restored to its normal state. But with the greenhouse effect, unfortunately, it's thousands of years, tens of thousands of years to purge the excess carbon that we're overloading the atmosphere with now from our gases, outputs of our industrial, civilized, maybe over-civilized ways. So if we overload the atmosphere with carbon dioxide, we've got a juggernaut coming, which is going to be really hard to stop. So the best we can do is just stop now or slow it down as much as we can. And the solution to that is not by suffering and sacrificing and scripting and saving and freezing in the dark, but rather embracing, I mean, some of that would probably be good for us too, where appropriate, discipline and efficiency, but especially efficiency with technology that performs the same services but uses much less energy in the process. And then what energy we do use, make it as carbon-free as possible so that we're not injecting carbon into the atmosphere. And that's the focus of today's talk. It's the technologies based on what I call sky power, which is solar power, wind power, rain, green plants, the heat of the earth, and ways to store this stuff, which involve hydrogen. And we'll talk about all that stuff. I've got a bunch of slides to show you. But since the whole focus of this is the sun, and as I say, the sun rules, I want to just do a little bit of celebrating our parent star, the sun, and show you some of the amazing power of the sun blasting material. I was talking on the stargazing hikes about the atoms in your bodies and how they have typically, a typical atom in your body has been recycled through three or four stars in the history of its billions of years of existence. And it's because stars are blowing off material all the time. The sun is sending solar wind off into the cosmos, and other stars are doing this, and other stars blow up in supernova, and all this stuff gets mixed into the interstellar medium, and it's the stuff of which nebulae are made that then planets and stars are formed from. And this has happened several times for most of the atoms in your body. I'm just going to show you the sun and some of the stuff blasting off from it. And there's a little gray disk in the middle of what you're about to see with a little circle drawn in the middle, which is where the sun actually would be, but the sun is masked off so it doesn't overload the optics of this satellite that this was shot from. And then you see these blasts of material going off for millions of miles, and you can also see it was shot over several days, and as the Earth moves around the sun appears to move against the background of stars, off in the direction of the constellation Sagittarius. Sagittarius is up nicely in the evening sky now, but it's down behind Copper Mountain, so because it's low, so you can see it on here though. And also there's a comet that falls into the sun right before it's going to loop through four times, and you're going to see this. A comet is a big, dirty snowball. It's what I call a flying, smoking glacier, and it comes in from the lower left, and comets usually come hurtling in from the far, frosty fringes beyond the solar system, and they whip around the sun and go way back out. But every now and then, quite often actually, in fact a number of them have been seen doing this with this satellite, they'll just fall right into the sun and vaporize, and you're going to see this happen here. So let me roll the tape. This only runs for a couple minutes, and it cycles through about four times, and then we're done. Oh, there it is already. So now, let's see, maybe we already missed one cycle of the comet. There it is right there on the lower left. And so the sun is the little white circle in the middle. You see the stars of the Milky Way, central region of the Milky Way, moving by in the background. Here comes that comet again. And there's just all those stuff that's called coronal mass ejections. The corona is the outer atmosphere of the sun. It's what you see during a total eclipse of the sun. There goes that comet again. So it's just a beautiful, kind of inspiring shot of what's going on in our sun. Every total solar eclipse, the atmosphere is in a different state. So sometimes the corona is short, little pearly, ghostly wings, and other times it's long streamers like what you were seeing there. And I have another videotape which shows some of the latest images from the Trace satellite, Transition and Coronal Explorer.
Trouble is I didn't really get this queued up, so I'm not sure if it's what I wanted, but let's see, we'll just run this and then we'll be done with the video.
Let's see, well, yeah, these are loops of plasma. Plasma is ionized gas. You can see it in the lower right, the profile of the sun. The sun is huge. It's like a basketball compared to a BB that you would shoot out of a gun for the Earth. Those loops are far bigger than the Earth. This is a time-lapse thing, so you know you can see a clock there up in the upper left there. And this is just showing some of the magnificent activity that's going on the surface of the sun all the time.
What is the loop?
Well, there are intense magnetic fields on the sun. Let me see here now. I might want to skip over some of this. There's something that shows how this satellite was launched. Let me see here. All right. Well, let's see here. There's something in here is, the intense magnetic fields of the sun. In fact, sunspots typically occur in pairs. There are these dark splotches on the sun's surface, and they're like opposite ends of these loops. That follow the magnetic field of the sun, which is always getting twisted. There are these massive things that look like tornadoes or twisters. There's some better ones a little bit later on in this tape, but they're, much bigger than the Earth. They're just really violent disturbances in the sun's magnetic field. Let me see here. Fast forward.
Where was this taken from, Joe?
This was taken from out in space, the Trace satellite.
Look at those.
Look at those twisters.
Whoa.
Those things are, you know, tens of times as big as the Earth. And it's in various wavelengths of light, and it's just amazing stuff that's going on in the sun. And every now and then there are solar storms that send all kinds of particles this way and that, and when they happen to be directed towards the Earth, you get the aurora australis for the southern hemisphere or borealis for the northern hemisphere.
Joe, did those twisters show up with sunspots?
They're parts of the complexes of sunspots. I'm going to just fast forward here and get to where, let's see, there's a certain part of this thing.
Now, is this part of the process that throws stuff off that has these little neutrons that come flying through the Earth where people are sitting in old salt mines waiting for them to come?
Oh, no, that's neutrinos, and those come from the sun, but they also come from supernovas. Well, I think that's enough. There was another part. I think I actually started after the part I wanted to show you, but that's a good enough idea. So, anyway, because the main part of this talk is actually these slides. That was just kind of a little science and wonder highlight, you know, since we want to celebrate the beauty and amazement of the cosmos here. But, so I guess we can get to the slides now. Thanks a lot, John. So, let's see, I have the controls with the slides, so we'll just get right into it. Well, a little bit more beauty of the cosmos, star clouds, and some of this I showed in my slideshow on atmospheric optical phenomena the other day. These are noctilucent clouds, night light. They're seen, you know, towards midnight in the high latitudes like Scandinavia in midsummer. They're the highest clouds known. They're about 50 miles high. And this doesn't have anything to do with renewable energy. It's just one of the effects of the sun on the atmosphere. The colors are caused by diffraction, which is a physics phenomenon that has to do with the wave nature of light, and you get these interference colors.
And I think
that was up in Sweden. Let's see, this is the aurora borealis, and this is like a huge fluorescent light in the sky. Charged particles from the sun come racing in our atmosphere. They strip electrons off atoms and molecules. It takes energy to do that. And then when the electrons recombine with the ions, they give off little quantum fluorescences all over the place. And that's what happens in a fluorescent light tube. And that's what's going on in the aurora. And when you have a solar storm with a lot more charged particles coming into our atmosphere, you get the aurora even as far south as Costa Rica, Florida, Texas. First one I ever saw was in Virginia. And this is just a testament to the power of the sun and its dominance on everything on the Earth. Now, here we go. This is a picture. I did not take this one, but this is an amazing shot of an iceberg both above and below the water. This really gives you a sense of the term, the tip of the iceberg. 1/10 of the mass of the iceberg is above the water, and 9/10 is below. This is a really clear, calm day in good, clear water. And the reason I show this is because this relates to the problem of global warming, climate change, which is what we're interested in the solutions to with reformed energy technologies. And I did the little experiment the other day. I'm not sure how many of you were here where we melted the ice in the water. If you put the ice in the water, in a cup of water, that raises the water level. But then when you let the ice melt, does everybody know what happens to the water level as the ice melts?
It goes down.
No,
it stays the same.
Okay, some people think it goes down, some say it goes up, but most of you are onto it. It stays the same. And so the sea level rise will not come from melting icebergs. It comes from melting ice that's on land and glaciers on the mountains that run off to sea, or things like the West Antarctic ice sheet that may be calving off into the oceans, like plopping ice into the water. But most importantly, the thermal expansion of the seawater. That's the biggest contributor to the sea level rise, which is going to cause havoc along the coastal areas of the world. And most of the world's people live in coastal areas. So they're going to be very vulnerable to, it's not like, in some cases, whole islands groups are going to be submerged, like the Maldives down in the Indian Ocean, that those people are going to have to move. But in other cases, it's not like they're going to be submerged, it's just that the waves during the wintertime are going to be causing a lot more damage than they ever used to, just because sea levels are creeping up on us. And this is already being observed. One other comment on ice, by the way, which I alluded to the other day, I forgot to get around to finishing, was that paradoxically, global warming could actually trigger not a full-scale ice age, but in certain parts of the world, like Greenland, Northern Europe, and even the northern part of the United States, we could see much colder temperatures quite suddenly if the Atlantic conveyor shuts off. The Atlantic conveyor is, well, sort of related to the Gulf Stream, but it's a belt of water that is circulating from the equator up towards the poles, and then it sinks due to the getting colder. It sinks up around Greenland, and it moderates a lot of the world's climate. And what's happening is in the northern hemisphere, and it depends on the saltiness of the water. And I told everybody the other day that one of the results of our global experiment with injecting too much carbon in the atmosphere is that over just the last quarter century, the polar region, the polar ice cap in the Arctic, is now 40% thinner on average than it was just 25 years ago, which is really alarming. I mean, but you say, well, okay, so what? So a lot of that ice melted. It's not changing the sea level, a lot of that ice is floating, but what it is changing is the salinity of the seawater. And so if the salinity of the seawater, you get a lot more big pools of fresh water floating around in the Arctic region, that could actually threaten to shut off this conveyor, which is going to play havoc with the climate on a significant part of the world. It may not be a complete global ice age or anything like that, but it could be essentially an ice age. And just in the last few decades, scientists have been realizing that some of the ice ages in the various cycles in the past have come on very suddenly, like in a matter of 20 years. So, by messing around with warming the global climate, we could actually end up causing ice age kinds of effects. The best analogy I've heard to what we're doing with this global experiment, I did not mention this the other day, I meant to, so here's something a little new, is it's like we're wandering around in a fog, and we think there may be a cliff edge somewhere in that fog, not too far ahead of us. Sort of like me yesterday wandering around up the mountainside. But anyway, we don't know for sure if there is a cliff edge there, and if there is, we have no idea how far away it is. But we're in this fog, and we could be approaching a cliff edge. Well, anyway, so there's enough gloom and doom for now. Let's get to the fun, exciting, good, positive parts. Okay, here are, well, there's something bad and something good, at least in my opinion, something bad. Now, there's actually a lot of good about nuclear energy. I mean, aside from the fact that the sun is powered by nuclear fusion, I mean, I love nuclear fusion, right up there at 93 million miles away in the sky where it belongs. That's our power plant. But nuclear fission for energy has all kinds of problems. The radioactive waste, what do you do with it? There is a substantial potential for terrorist diversion of the fuel. You have to have a military state if you're going to be powering a lot of the world with nuclear. I mean, France has been doing this so far, there haven't been any significant problems there, but it's just a matter of time, I think. And not to mention the fact you've got uranium mining and you've got to truck the fuel in and all this kind of stuff. And the biggest liability of nuclear power, I think, is the fact that it's got to be big centralized power plants. There isn't really any way to make decentralized small-scale nuclear power plants where you can have many little ones all over the place. And that's the beauty of solar. This thing down here is not a swimming pool. It's a big array of photovoltaic cells. Photo is in light, volts is in electricity, light to electricity directly with no noise, pollution, or moving parts. It's the miracle technology of the new millennium. And it's been around for a long time, and it's been very expensive for a long time. However, the price has dropped 100-fold in the last few decades. It's continuing to come down, but it's starting to level off. And all we need is another factor of two or three in the price drop to where it'll be affordable for everybody, and it'll be a no-brainer for everybody. And I just was reading, I recommend about four different magazines over in the rack over there. There's one called Co-op America Quarterly. It's got a whole bunch of great stuff in there about energy. And there's a new initiative that Co-op America has called the Solar Catalyst Group. You can take a look at the little article there. And what they're going to do is they've picked California because it's a major market and it's got a lot of potential, but it could happen anywhere. They're going to make a concerted effort to try to get the government to underwrite the manufacture and installation of tons and tons of photovoltaics to begin to get the price down by the economies of scale and the mass production. I mean, you know, think about it. The reason why everybody has a computer on their desk now is because back in the 60s and 70s, the government made massive public purchases of the technology that stimulated that industry. I mean, a lot of people are free marketeers, and I believe in the free market. It does a lot of things very well. But let's face it, the aircraft industry, the computer industry, all these guys got their big breaks from the government, basically. I'm not saying the government doing things and micromanaging things. That's what a lot of people complain about, and that's what I don't think is appropriate. But the government can be a good customer, and the biggest customer for solar energy could be the federal government and the state governments. And if, you know, it's still too expensive for you to put on your own home, although I can help you out with that, I can tell you where to go and where to look up things up, but you can certainly work on helping your community, put them on schools and on businesses and on government, you know, city hall buildings. And, you know, public deployment of solar energy is the way to get the mass production and the economies of scale that we need to get this, that last factor of two or three down to where it will become affordable for everybody. And this is going to be a multi-trillion dollar industry, because here's a you get nothing else from this seminar. And I've said this a few times, usually under the stars, but get this one wired and tell everybody you meet. There's enough energy coming in from the sun every hour hitting the land area of the United States to power the entire country for a whole year. And we're wasting most of that. We're just forfeiting. Now people say, yeah, but don't you have to pave the whole country with photovoltaics to harvest that? No. In fact, another slide here in a minute shows you that only a circle in an area 50 miles in radius would be enough to, if you put solar panels throughout that circle, that would provide all the electricity this whole country needs. And you don't need to put it all in one place anyway. You wouldn't want to, because then you'd have to wire it out all across the country. Instead, put it in many, many little power plants distributed all over the place, including, I'm getting way ahead of myself here, but my idea of the killer app for photovoltaics, the killer application, is parking lot shade canopies. But, you know, people pay to park in the sun down at the boardwalk in Santa Cruz. They pay even more to park in the shade, especially if the shade canopies have solar panels on them that are all tied into the grid as mini power plants. And that's the way to go.
Have you proposed that idea to anybody?
Oh yeah, we've been talking about it. I mean, it's expensive. You know, you got to get the capital together to do it.
Right,
you know,
right.
So we're working on grants, and there are some states or national subsidy programs, but it takes forever to get these things. I actually have written 17 grants to put solar on schools in our area, and that's going to be happening in the next year. And, now, the thing about this, all the price of conventional energy sources is only going to go up. And not only the price out of your pocketbook, but the more important externalities costs to the environment and to our health. All those costs are going up. The future is bleak for oil, coal, natural gas. I mean, not to mention the geopolitical problems that are involved with oil, okay, and so on. But this, the future is bright. The costs are coming down. It's clean. And I tell people that this is going to be the industry that is going to make internet.com blah, blah look like nothing, because that was a lot of hype. And I mean, it's really important, the information age and all that, and the internet's great. But everybody needs energy all the time. And increasingly, we need clean energy.
So is this a stock tip?
Oh, I'll give you some stock tips later on. Remind me. But what are these things made of? They're usually made of silicon, which is the second most abundant element in the Earth's crust, the most abundant being oxygen. And so we're not going to run out of silicon anytime soon. So now nuclear power, the benefits of it are, as I mentioned the problems earlier, but the benefits, which you need to be prepared for because people are going to hit you with this. No in-your-face air pollution. No greenhouse gas emissions. I mean, those are good aspects of nuclear fission power plants. But as I said, there are those other problems and financing and just the fact that it's a big centralized thing and it takes a long time to get the capital together to do it. There are other, all kinds of problems that I think it's just going to die under its own weight.
Are there weather constrictions to photovoltaics, like snow, for example? I mean, is this as good for northern climates?
People do it in snow all the time, yeah. It just, the snow either sloughs off or you get up there once in a while and, you know, just shovel it off or whatever. And in fact, the solar panels actually work better. Solar panels work better in cold, clear conditions. Well, different kinds of solar panels. The amorphous silicon ones actually work better in warmer conditions. Here's that slide I promised you. That's the all the area you need to power the entire country with solar.
What are the impacts of mining silicon and processing it to make the...
Well, you know, there are some toxic waste products from manufacturing solar cells, but it's nothing compared to the toxics that are involved with burning coal or oil or natural gas. And it's a fairly high energy intensity process to make solar cells too. Everything takes energy. And as I said the other day, nothing is perfect. You always have to ask, compared to what? And when you compare solar to anything else, it's just orders of magnitude better.
Okay, fuel cell technology.
Well, I'm gonna get to that in just a minute. Here are, that's a bright star on the horizon. Here's a remote application on a farm. If you're off the power grid, it's a no-brainer right now to do solar, because extending the power grid costs $10,000 to $50,000 a mile. So you don't want to do that. You might as well spend that money on having your own solar. Here's a cloudy day. Certain kinds of solar panels work just fine in diffuse light conditions. This is for pumping water. Solar's ready for the big time, too. Here's a big centralized power plant. But again, I like sort of the idea of the decentralized. And that way, and it's modular, too. You don't have to wait 10 years to get the capital together and spend another 10 years building a big centralized behemoth. You can put this stuff up in a hurry as needed. And that's the beauty of solar. You don't overbuild like they did up here in Washington State with the whoops situation. I guess you all know what I'm talking about. The big nuclear white elephants that they, planned it wrong. So you can have off-grid solar, homes that are remote. And there you need to have batteries and all that for storage. But the beauty, maybe people don't realize that probably the fastest growing segment of solar is going to be the grid tied sector. You know what I mean by that? Grid interconnected solar, where you're tied into the grid and you don't even need batteries for storage, because when it's cloudy or dark, you just draw power from the grid. And when it's sunny, you generate your own power and then some. And you actually literally run your electric meter backwards, feeding power to your neighbors. You become a mini solar plant. And that's happening all over the place, all over the country now. A whole bunch of states now have what's called net metering. It used to be that you got kind of ripped off. The power companies resisted this for the longest time, because they've put a lot of money and effort into setting up that grid, and now they don't want a bunch of little people coming in generating their own power. Well, they're going to have to move over and face the fact that that's exactly what we need, and we need them to supply the services of their grid. So it used to be they'd charge you, 10 or 15 cents a kilowatt hour for their electricity, and they'd pay you back 2 cents for the stuff you generate. But now it's a one-to-one, so you literally run the meter backwards. So, and in California, there's a subsidy of up to half the cost of a grid-tied photovoltaic system. So the economics is good. And that's the idea of that, is to stimulate the industry and help it get going.
Hey, Joe?
Yeah?
Eventually, after people start grid-tying all their solar panels, aren't they going to have more energy during the day than they can actually use? And wouldn't they need batteries at that point? Somebody will need batteries to store it till tonight.
We'll see. That's if everything was just solar. But see, when the sun doesn't shine, often the wind is blowing the most when the sun's not shining. In fact, Altamont Pass and the other pass in California, where the most wind power so far in the U.S. has been deployed, those things are howling the most at nighttime. Okay. And the point I'm getting at is you need a diversity of renewable energy sources. Of course, there's lots of hydro, big and small, which is what I think we need a lot more of. There's potential for 50,000 small hydropower plants in this country from dams that already exist that were used for flood control, irrigation, things like that, milling. And I'll show you some pictures of that in a minute. But so hydro biomass, which is another thing. So there are many, many sources of good, clean, homegrown energy that can all tie into the grid. If it was all solar, Well, we're nowhere near that point anyway. That's something that's, you know, that scenario is decades in the future in any case.
But if your power was supplied by solar, then the power plants wouldn't be going during the day.
What's that?
If your power plants aren't needing to make power because enough solar is going, they're just resting, waiting to supply power, or do you store the power? I guess that was his question, is what do you do? You have this hydro dam, if everybody is producing half the power during the day, then you just turn on the hydro at night?
Well, that's one idea. And there are all kinds of different ways to store the energy. I'm going to get to that a little bit later, but let me just race through a little bit more of this here, and we can get into some of the Q&A in a minute. This is the one of the examples where you can cover parking lots with solar. Actually, this particular thing is extruded plastic Fresnel lenses that focus the sun onto very small amounts of the expensive silicon. And so you can get away with less of the expense of the silicon. And this is down in Austin, Texas, where you have a lot of direct sun. And the focusing works really well, but you need a lot of direct sun. It won't work very well in diffuse light. But it also provides shade for the car. Now here's up in New England. And if they can do this there, this is a grid tie system where they're tied into the grid. And part of the beauty of solar is that the supply fluctuates in phase with the demand. I mean, when, especially say in California, when's the big energy crisis? When do we most need our electricity?
When it's hot.
Hot summer days and everybody turns on their air conditioning. Well, when do we most have the power available from the sky?
When it's
at
hot.
At the same time. So that's part of the beauty of solar, is that the natural cycle is exactly as we need it.
Did that just augment the power at that place? That those solar panels?
Oh yeah, I mean to supply the entire demand for that Burger King, you probably need two or three times as much as what you had there. So they're offsetting the demand for fossil fuel electricity.
Sure.
I mean, here's the thing you got to know. This will inform some of this discussion. The reason I say we're so far away from even having to worry about those issues of everybody having solar storing, here's the deal. Okay, California consumes the power demand for California at peak is about 50 gigawatts. That's 50,000 megawatts, 50 billion watts. Okay, the worldwide production of solar photovoltaics last year, total number of solar cells had a capacity of 350 megawatts, as opposed to the 50,000 megawatts that just California needs. So, you know, 50 gigawatts, and the worldwide production of photovoltaics last year was 0.350 gigawatt, a third of 1 gigawatt. So you can see how far off we are. Now, solar is the second fastest growing energy source in the world. The industry is growing at 30% a year, but we're starting from such a minuscule baseline, due largely to just lack of vision and expenditure and public support, that, you know, it's going to take a while, even at that really great rate, for it to get to where it's really making a significant dent in things. But we need that to happen as soon as possible. Now, wind power is the fastest growing energy source in the world, and it's already got a bit more of a foothold. We'll talk about that in a minute. This is a solar water heating system, and this already pays in many applications because the price of natural gas is going to be problematic. You know, what you aren't hearing is that everybody's saying, oh, we still got plenty of natural gas, but the natural gas supplies for this country are increasingly having to come from remote boreal forests of Canada in environmentally sensitive areas and things like that. So natural gas is not a good thing to be banking the future on.
Where's the water heating system on the house?
Oh, it's this little panel up here that is made of a dark material that absorbs sunlight and transfers the heat to copper pipes, and you have your water might circulate through the copper pipes, and then with a heat exchanger you heat up the water that you use for washing and cooking.
It's an example of how efficient that is. My brother-in-law had one of those on his house down here by Portland, Oregon, and he was using it to heat hot water, got all the hot water he could use, and he was watering his lawn with hot water with the excess. Just because to keep it from overheating.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, and the thing is, a lot of people, when you hear solar, they say, oh, you got plumbing problems, I had pipes breaking. Now, with solar electricity, most people don't even realize that solar electricity is none of that stuff. There's no plumbing, no moving parts. It's state-of-the-art space-age technology that works. These things, you know, some of the old solar hot water heating systems still have problems. If it freezes, if you don't have a freeze protection valve, you can have these things blowing out on you, and then you know, people have, are left over with problems from back in the earlier generations of these things. But the modern technologies work quite well. And here's a dairy farm that's using solar for preheating the water that's used in, you know, washing down milking equipment and stuff like that. That's in Maryland. Here's an application that's just a no-brainer right now. You can save, within 3 years, you pay back the cost of your investment in a solar hot water heating system for pools. You save on your, you know, there's no natural gas bills. And again, the time when you most need the solar energy, the heating for the pools, is when people are most likely to be using pools, is the time when you have the most solar energy coming in. Now, here's an interesting technology. There's about 10 of these plants down in the desert, in the Mojave Desert in California. And this technology is very successful. It's still operating. These are big parabolic trough mirrors that focus the sun under these pipes at the focus of each of the mirrors. And these pipes have a working fluid in them that's an oil-based material, and it gets the temperature up to about 800 degrees Fahrenheit. And then this fluid is collected at a central station where it heats, flashes water to steam, which then turns a turbine to make electricity. And it's called solar electric generating system. And I had a little illustration of a generator here. Now this is more apropos of wind power, but you know, even wind, you know, turns turbines, and water, like here at the hydropower plant, turns turbines. In fact, I just noticed this time, did you all see the Pelton wheel that's buried in the ground right under the dining hall up there? There's a water wheel, Pelton wheel. And, but the thing is, even the fossil fuel power sources involve turning things. Now, photovoltaics doesn't. That's just no moving parts again. But turning things, how does that make electricity anyway? What is it in things that turn that makes the electricity?
Magnets.
There's magnets and wires. And if you move magnets with respect to wires, or wires with respect to magnets, lo and behold, you get electrons flowing through the wires. This was something that a guy named Oersted discovered by accident back in the 1850s, and it was part of the inspiration of Einstein's relativity theory, was the fact that the motion could be either of the magnets or of the wires, and that leads to a symmetry in Maxwell's equations of electrodynamics, which stimulated his thinking about relativity. But anyway, here's the thing. It's got these little red lights. And by the way, guess who first came up with the, well, Einstein got his Nobel Prize not on relativity and gravity and all this stuff, but he got his Nobel Prize on the photoelectric effect, studying that, which is what photovoltaics are based on. Well, anyway, this thing here has red lights, and I'm going to act like I'm going to whack you with it, and I'm going to do it for you folks, and then you folks, and you'll see as I get this thing spinning just from the wind motion that you'll see the red lights light up. So tell me if you see it.
Ooh.
See that? It's there. Just from spinning, there's just little magnets and wires in here, and that's all it takes to light this thing up. I mean, so you can make your electricity either by hiring a whole army of gerbils to turn turbines, you know, you can have exercise bicycles in gyms, you know, they can power a bank of lights, or you know, you can have water. What was that?
Then you have a methane problem.
Well, anyway, so this thing, the hot oil goes off and flashes water to steam, which turns a turbine to make electricity. And here's another example. This is a power tower in the Mojave Desert. Anybody ever see the movie Baghdad Cafe?
Yes.
Yeah. I highly recommend that. Rent that on video. It's a great story, beautiful scenery. It was shot down in the Mojave Desert, and there was this really eccentric artist guy with a big 10-gallon hat who falls in love with the protagonist woman. And he's this artist, and he's captivated by these big X's of light that are up in the sky. And it comes from these mirrors. There's a field of about 2,000 heliostats, or mirrors, which are tracking the sun, and they focus the sun onto the top of this tower. And some, at certain times, you can see the beams of light kind of focusing at certain points in the sky. And anyway, he was captivated with that. There's some really interesting scenery in the movie. But again, there's water or a working fluid up there that's flashed. It flashes water to steam to turn a turbine and makes electricity. And this power plant is declared a success. They've recently improved it so that they can actually store enough heat in molten salts that change phase with heating and cooling, so that you can go through up to 4 days of hardly any sun at all and still have the heat retained in there to keep turning the water to steam to make electricity. Here's a house which was built in the 70s and has zero electric and heating bill. It's actually a net energy producer. It utilizes not only solar electric and solar hot water heating, but also daylighting and passive solar is one of the most important things. Architects, you know, Architects need to learn a lot. They may not know that or admit that or want you to know that, but they need to learn a lot about simple things like the orientation of housing developments, the houses in those developments. In this part of the world, the sun never gets straight overhead. It's always south of straight overhead, and things should be facing south. And you do tricks here, like you have your eaves hanging over the edge of the house at an angle that screens out the high midday sun in the summertime, but which lets in the low midday sun in the wintertime. And then you can store your heat in thermal mass, which is, you know, concrete or stone or masonry, and all kinds of great techniques for that. Here's what's called vision glass, by the way. This is in an airport walkway. This is glass that's tinted with a photovoltaic material that actually acts as the power plant. It's making electricity, and it also provides shading in the walkway.
Joe, on that previous slide, were those the roof tiles?
On that house, there were some, yeah. There are actually, there's what's called building integrated photovoltaics now. In fact, somebody here was talking about a company called Unisolar that makes this stuff. It's like a peel and stick, thin film photovoltaics that you can apply to standing seam metal roofs, and now it's being developed so you can even apply it straight to plywood, and it becomes part of your roof. So your roof doubles as the power plant. Well, I think I'm running out of time, so I've got to move on here. This is a daylighting example in the 3M building in Austin. This was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. And daylighting is a really important solar energy source because not only does it save on your electricity bills and the environment and all that, but even more importantly than the savings on your electric bill is the morale and productivity of the workers. It's all kinds of studies are now showing that workers perform much better when they have natural daylighting. And not only that, school kids perform much better on tests and things. And you know, a lot of schools nowadays don't even have any daylight, and they're just covered with cinder block walls, I guess because they don't want to deal with vandalism to windows or something. But it's nice to get windows there wherever. Now at night, you know, you're still going to have artificial, you know, electricity lighting or whatever, but when you can offset as much of it as possible in the daytime, that's just more to the good. And even, I think Walmart or somebody noticed that shoppers do better, or better for their bottom line anyway, or something, by having natural lighting in some of these businesses. And by the way, businesses are a major, I mean, every time I fly into Los Angeles or San Jose, I look down at all those flat-roofed industrial buildings, and I say, man, what a waste. You know, all those things could be just paved with photovoltaics if we could crank out enough of that stuff. Here's a roof that is paved with photovoltaics. That's the roof of Clint Eastwood's golf course clubhouse at Tehama in the Carmel Valley down near Monterey. And just before the September 11th weekend, there was a local government conference on solar and renewable energy and options for local governments, and got the one of Clint Eastwood's close business associates to give us a little tour up there along with the mayor of Arcata, which is a very green government town up in far northern California. These are power light panels that lie flat on the roof, so they're not tipped to optimize the solar gain, but you save more than that lost by just the fact that it's so easy to install. And they fit like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, and they actually help shelter the roof from water damage and from ultraviolet, and most importantly, the thermal load. There's 40% less heating and cooling demand for the building because these things are mounted on an insulating material. This is looking at the edge of it. It's kind of like a styrofoam sort of thing, but much more durable. That stuff on top is sort of like shotcrete, and then just on top of that is where, with an air pocket to keep the panels cool, you have your solar panels would be the edge of them up on top of that. And, well, heck, just while we're here, give you a little armchair tour of Clint Eastwood's golf course, since we're never going to get to go there.
Are those things being retrofitted easily?
Oh, yeah. There's yours truly putting with my foot on the golf green there. But, Powerlight. Go to powerlight.com. And these are, they're mostly for big applications, like businesses, commercial. They don't really, they're not so much into the home market.
Schools?
Schools would be perfect. Okay, wind. Now, why is wind a form of solar energy? I mean, what makes the wind? It's the uneven heating of the earth by the sun between the poles and the equator, night and day, oceans and land, highlands and lowlands, that causes wind. And we've already gone into how you get electricity from things turning. There's a little person there for scale. Now, one of the disadvantages, one of the very few disadvantages of wind power, which fortunately is drastically decreasing, is what?
Bird
kill. And that used to be a problem with this kind of wind turbine, the old kind that have these places on the towers for birds to perch, and they're shorter. But these new modern turbines, and the Danes make the best ones. And if you want a good investment, some Copenhagen Stock Exchange, Vestas, V-E-S-T-A-S. They're the best in the world, and they're going gangbusters making these ultra-modern megawatt-scale wind turbines. They're taller, farther, fewer between. The blades turn slower, and the towers don't have any place for birds to perch. So it's greatly reduced the bird kill problem. And so let's move on here. That's Altamont Pass in California. Here's a design, the egg beater rotor called the Darius rotor. And it was thought that it was really going to make great gains. But then they were discovering that because of wind shear between the lower part and the higher part, it was causing mechanical stresses and fatigue in the metal. So the maintenance jacks up the cost. But wind is actually about the cheapest source of energy now. And for that reason, among others, it's the fastest growing in the world. It's growing in excess of 40% a year, which is good news. And guess who has the Saudi Arabia of wind? The United States. In the Plain States, North Dakota and Texas alone have wind resources that can power more than the entire electrical demand of this whole country. Most of it's deployed out in California, but we're not anywhere near being the champions in terms of resource. And all through Indian country and Montana and Wyoming, there are tremendous wind resources. And in that same magazine, Co-op America Quarterly, I just read about a way that you can help put wind turbines up on some Indian reservations. They're trying to get the capital together to do this, and they can own and control the stuff and benefit from it, and the environment benefits and all that. It's called Wind Builders Program, and it's, if you go to, I think it's nativeenergy.com or something like that, it's over there in that magazine. But okay, here's another form of solar energy. Now, why is hydropower, now this is the big bad kind. I went up the Yangtze River in China a couple summers ago and saw that massive Three Gorges Dam. You know, you see these signs way, way up on the mountainsides that is where the water level is supposed to be a few years from now if they continue to finish that thing. And, you know, of course, they're having to evacuate over 3 million people. Priceless archaeological treasures are going to be flooded and so on. Not to mention slapping a 500-mile-long reservoir of water behind this dam, which is what's going to happen. I'm not convinced that that's not seismic. I mean, it's in a fairly seismically active area, and just suddenly putting all that weight. I mean, water weighs a lot, by the way. You may not know, but a box of water 1 meter on a side, guess how much that weighs? It weighs 1 metric ton, 2,200 pounds of water. That's why when you carry water on your backpacking trip, it's kind of heavy. But anyway, you put 500-mile reservoir of water behind a dam, and that, I think, is a problem. And the dam itself is a terrorist target, you know, potentially, and all this stuff. Big dams, not so good. But why? By the way, why is hydro a form of solar energy? What powers the water cycle? Remember, evaporation, condensation, precipitation, and all powered by the sun. So, solar energy. The sun rules. So now here are the small dams that we have 50,000 of these all over the country that could be retrofitted for hydropower production. And now here's one of my favorites. This is something new. It's just at the point of becoming commercialized. Wave power. Now the sun's not always shining, the wind's not always blowing, but the waves are always there. And waves are basically a form of solar energy because waves are driven by the wind, and the wind is caused by the sun, so it's ultimately a form of, it's all sky power, you know. But here's one design. This actually looks a lot like the coast just north of Santa Cruz. And we're looking into maybe deploying something like this in Santa Cruz, although actually the waves are better up closer to Arcata, far northern California. And so if we're going to do, well, we can do these all over the place. And here's an interesting fact. Every meter, which is a little bit longer than a yard, of coastline has an average wave power coming through it of 20 kilowatts. Now, just for reference, a typical American home needs about 5 kilowatts. So, you know, 4 or 5 American, which is pretty energy extravagant typically, homes could be powered by the wave power coming through just 1 meter of coastline. So it's a tremendous resource, and the idea is you'd put these things out there that maybe are the size of small delivery trucks, and they'd be a couple miles offshore in one design. There are others, there's a company called wavegen.com, check that one out. They're in Scotland, and they're deploying things on coastal rocks, and they use the up and down of the water to drive turbines to make electricity. This would use the waves out at sea, the up and down rocking motion of the oscillating water column to make turbines turn and turn electricity, which is then wired to shore. And in the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary, which is where Santa Cruz is located, you know, you've got issues of fishing and making sure you don't, you know, have to put up navigation and lighting buoys and things and put these things on maps and all kinds of, a host of things that need to be finessed. But, you know, it's better than smokestacks.
It's like you get electric oil spills.
they're in oil spills. This is a geothermal plant in the geysers area of California. Geothermal is a vast resource which we've barely begun to tap. And it's not just in areas like Idaho, and I mean, you hear about geothermal hot springs in Idaho and in parts of California, but it's all over the country, really. I mean, it's not that you have hot springs all over the country, but there's hot, dry rock less than 2 miles down in many, many places. And in fact, I think here's a picture of something in California near Mammoth. Now, here's where it's really unusually close to the surface, but Magma Power is a company there that's operating. They're injecting water down to where it gets in contact with this really hot. Actually, there are some worries that the Mammoth area could erupt sometime, not, you know, maybe in our lifetimes again. But you get the water heated to steam, which then turns a turbine to make electricity. But geothermal has tremendous potential, and we're not even hardly beginning to try to exploit it. It's not exactly sky power, except in the sense that where does geothermal come from? It comes from the heat of the earth. And the earth, where did the earth come from? It came from the sky. It came from a big cloud of dust and gas called nebula about 4.5 billion years ago. And most of that stuff collapsed under the force of gravity to become the sun, but little side swirls became the planets. And so it's the internal heat of the formation of the earth, which is still leaking out all over the place. And you can tap that to make electricity. ASAP.
Well, can geothermal be distributed in terms of small scale?
Very well. It's located all over the place, and you can wire the power out from the power plants that you build over substantial distances. So, I'm just kind of racing on here. I want to try to allow time for questions at the end. I'm sorry, I'm kind of giving them a little bit short shrift, but I'm worried that we may not finish. What time is it anyway?
23.
We have till a quarter of. Is that right? Okay. So here's another form of solar energy: biomass, green plants. And, you know, here's a poplar, I think it's poplar plantation. How's that solar? Well, why are plants green anyway? Chlorophyll. Chlorophyll is tuned to harvest the sunlight to make energy and food for plants. Now, here's a question for you, though. What if you tried to grow plants under a pure green light? Green is the light that the plants waste. They reject, they scatter it, they reflect it back to the environment. They don't use the green. The plants, typically in photosynthesis, use the red and the blue parts of the spectrum. That's the light wavelengths that are most responsible for growth of plants. So, anyway, green, it's just an interesting little science fact there, but green, you see, you know, the world evolved using solar energy. All this greenery, all over the mountains and everywhere you go, you see green leaves, you see green forests, hillsides, grasses. That's all a testament to the power of the sun, providing, you know, our food, and just the basis of all life. And, I guess there is some life down at the bottoms of the oceans that feeds off hydrothermal vents and their sulfur-based metabolisms and things like that. But for the most part, it's all driven by the sun. And the thing that's interesting about biomass energy is that, when you, say, if you burn wood for heat or to make electricity, or you burn alcohol that you make from fermenting sugarcane like they do in the automotive economy of Brazil, or other liquid fuels like what we could make from biomass, well, you do emit some carbon dioxide, but it's almost exactly compensated for by the fact that when these plants grew, what did they do about carbon dioxide? They sucked it out of the atmosphere. So there's no net new contribution of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. So that's good. Whereas with fossil fuels, which also are derived ultimately from, you know, millions of year old plants, they got turned into coal or oil or natural gas. Well, those plants suck carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, but that was way, way long time ago. So essentially, when you burn those things, the fossil fuels, now you're just dumping new carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. But with the biomass economy, it's coming and going all the time. No new carbon dioxide, to paraphrase a George Bush Sr. phrase. No new taxes. Read my lips. No new carbon dioxide. So here's just a biomass picture from New England. I come from Virginia, and I miss the fall colors. We do get them in California, and they stretch all the way into December, but you don't get the whole mountainside of them like you do in the Appalachians and Skyline Drive and that bright blue October weather. So I guess you get some pretty good colors up here, I think, maybe the aspen trees. Here's another form of biomass, landfills. Landfills build up by the fermentation of the trash, methane, CH4, natural gas. very potent greenhouse gas. You don't want it leaking to the atmosphere. You'd rather flare it off and just burn it, but ideally you would burn it in a combustion turbine, make electricity from it, or heat stuff with it, or something. And so many landfills are outfitted with this, and you should check in your community and see if your landfill's big enough to do this, and if they aren't doing it, well then why not? They should be making electricity or otherwise utilizing the energy that comes from the methane that's generated by our trash. Ultimately, our solar power trash. A lot of our trash is paper, and where does paper come from? It comes from trees, which grow from the sun. So, and here's another form of biomass. In the developing world, there are about 6 million of these biogas digesters that use animal dung. In India, there's about 5 or 6 million. In China, even many more. And again, you're making methane in these things from the animal dung, which, you know, the animals ate food and the food grew off the solar energy. So, I mean, let's face it, you know, we're all solar powered, okay? I mean, we go eat our lunch here in an hour or so. That lunch is made from plants which grew from the sun. And even if you're eating animal products, well, the animals ate plants and so on. By the way, just remember, I should put in a plug just as a little bit of a resource thing, a really great organization for learning more about solar, and if you want to learn how to design and install your own photovoltaic system or help neighbors or whatever do it, or wind power or hydropower, go to this organization right here. Ironically, they're based in Carbondale, Colorado, but Solar Energy International, www.solarenergy.org, great little organization. And so anyway, I got a whole bunch more references to tell you in a little while, but let's move on. Okay, now here's something interesting. The tropics is where the solar resource is the greatest, and yet the money is the least. I mean, it's where a lot of the developing world lies. But there are exciting new ventures where they're forming micro-enterprise, micro-credit companies where people can buy solar or kind of lease it and pay the same amount per month as they would pay for diesel fuel or whatever that they normally have to truck in there, batteries, you know, recharging batteries. They can instead just pay a certain amount per month and have their power delivered by solar, which these companies will come around and install. And they're training lots of people to do this on the thatched roof huts and things. Now, why? Does anybody know I might have said this during a star hike, but if you know the answer, don't yell right out. But most people don't know what the definition of the tropics is, actually. It's an astronomical definition. It has a lot to do with sunlight and why the sun is most abundant in the tropics. That zone of the earth between 23.5 north and south, between the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn, that's the tropics. Why is that tropics? What is it about the sky? The
sun's vertical on each end.
It's the zone on the earth where the sun can be directly overhead. Everywhere in between those two tropics, at two times of the year, the sun is directly overhead. Nowhere outside the tropics is the sun ever directly overhead. So, okay, and at the Tropic of Cancer and at the Tropic of Capricorn, it's overhead exactly once, right at the solstices, winter and summer. So that's the idea. That's what the tropics is. The basic point is there's a lot of sun down there. And so it's and the developing world, along with Jonathan and many of us here, feel that poverty is the number one problem. Poverty and developer are the number one problems that the world's so-called civilization needs to grow up and deal with. I consider that, I mean, that's one thing I'm going to hammer home to these school kids that I'm supposed to be teaching math and physics to. I want to get as many people as I can interested in doing something about solving the unnecessary problem of poverty. And part of the reason I'm excited about sky power, renewable energy, other than the fact that I like the sky and all that, and that it brings together all the different academic disciplines and there's something in it for everybody educationally, is the fact that it can do a lot for poverty. Because instead of paying scarce capital to huge centralized sort of fat cat energy schemes, instead you can get people relying on their own local, decentralized, homegrown, democratically distributed energy sources that are coming in all the time from everywhere in the sky. So I hope that's making sense. Here's wood stoves. That's what a lot of people use for their energy, and there are more modern, efficient wood stoves, which are good, but a lot of women walk many miles, you know, tens of miles a day for increasingly scarce firewood. And, the acute respiratory infection that comes from indoor cooking fires is the leading health hazard in places like Kenya, where we went and did a solar oven project once, helped these rural villagers, and they just went to town making their own solar ovens. And, I mean, we could do that in this country, too, and it doesn't really require any change in lifestyle. You just have to accept that, okay, you remember, okay, I'm going to put the food in a few hours before it's time to eat. And then you don't have to sit there in the oven. It takes a few hours to cook it by just the heat of the sun being trapped inside this little greenhouse, basically. greenhouse effect par excellence inside that box there. But you just sort of plan things so that you put the food in advance, and then you come back later. It's like a crock pot. It's not burnt. It's ready. And so there you go. Solar ovens is all over the place. You can make them real cheaply with cardboard boxes and double glazing plastic and a little bit of aluminum foil, and go to town. All right, well, this is an old picture of one of the first electric vehicles called the, I always thought it was a strange name for a car, the Impact. But this is what's now the GM EV, I guess. They're starting to look different. And electric cars are good because, rather than burning fossil fuels, you're making your power from electricity. However, if you plug it into the wall and your power plant is fueled by fossil fuels, which most of them are, well, then you're just putting the problem onto a centralized location. But it's still better that way than having many, many little polluters running around on the roads. And okay, if you are going to have pollution from fossil fuels, you can have it off in some remote location, or sometimes that ends up being on Indian lands or something like that, so there are social justice issues involved. But actually, battery electric cars, we're leapfrogging that now completely with the hybrids. Well, not with this. This is a futuristic thing. This is a race down the East Coast. Solar is a great resource, but it's so diffuse that you need a substantial area to harvest enough of it to power a car. You'd need solar panels that would extend beyond the edge of the roof of the car, unless it's a funny little super lightweight composite material job like that one. But here's the idea. Here is a hydrogen-powered car. And I said this the other day, I'll say it again, you've got to say it too. The best kept secret in the world is that the U.S. and all the other countries, really, could make all the energy we need to power everything. Schools, homes, offices, factories, and cars and trucks with hydrogen. Hydrogen made from local, homegrown, renewable energy sources. The exhaust when you consume hydrogen is pure water. So it's spectacular for the environment and even more so for the economy. Now, there are several ways to do it. This is an internal combustion engine hydrogen car. But these new things that you mentioned earlier, the fuel cells, people didn't even know about these things 3 or 4 years ago. Actually, NASA's known about it for a long time. The astronauts have been drinking the exhaust from their onboard power plant for years, since the Gemini days. The fuel cell makes the electricity, and they drink the water that is the exhaust. But most people haven't even heard of fuel cells until just recently. These are quiet, clean electrochemical devices that are 3 times as efficient as internal combustion engines. They have there's several different designs of them. But you feed them hydrogen, and unfortunately, there's a big debate going on. You should know about this. There's a big debate. Which way are we going to go? Are we going to make the hydrogen directly and feed that into the fuel cell, which is the ideal way economically and environmentally, or are we going to do what the oil industry wants us to do and have costly, complex onboard reforming devices that strip the hydrogen out of oil that they want to keep us addicted to, and then feed the oil, then feed the hydrogen to the fuel cell? That is still actually cleaner than what we have now because the fuel cell is so efficient. I mean, even doing that would be better, but you could say, well, it's also good because it's a stepping stone. We don't have to change too much. We don't have to have hydrogen refueling infrastructure all around. I mean, there's something to be said for that. But what I'm worried about is instead of it being a stepping stone, it'll become a roadblock or a dead end, and we'll just stay addicted to oil, way too long. I mean, it's already bad enough. So we need to really start working on getting that hydrogen infrastructure there. The fuel cells are coming along very nicely. In fact, you want a couple of investments, FCEL, Fuel Cell Energy, Plug Power, PLUG, Ballard Power Systems in Vancouver, BLDP. I'll give you all these stock symbols later. But it's amazing technology, but the hydrogen infrastructure is what we still need to work on. How are you going to make hydrogen? Well, here's one way. Turns out that algae were recently discovered to be able to make prodigious amounts of hydrogen. Again, it's a biomass source, basically, and it's powered by the sun, ultimately, because it's algae get their energy from the sun. And, it turns out if you starve the algae of sulfur, they snap back into an ancient mode that predated photosynthesis on the Earth, where photosynthesis is usually the byproduct is oxygen, but they snap into a mode where their byproduct is hydrogen. And great amounts of it. And this is all just going to be one piece of the puzzle. I mean, you can also make hydrogen just by electrolyzing water with, solar power or wind power. Now, you wouldn't want to go directly and do that because it's inefficient to electrolyze water. It takes a lot of energy to do that. Maybe you just want to just use your wind power or solar power to directly power things. But where you need to store a lot of energy, hydrogen, and this gets to some of the questions that you were asking about storing energy. Hydrogen is a great way to, it's the best way to bottle and transport solar energy and to use it when the sun's not shining or the wind's not blowing. And now here's something I have to address. Everybody, first thing you think of, what's this guy ranting and raving about hydrogen? Isn't it dangerous stuff? Yes, it's very dangerous. However, it's not as dangerous as gasoline, which is also dangerous. I mean, they have different ranges of danger, okay? A lot of people think the Hindenburg, you know, that's one of the things you think about, the Hindenburg that blew up or something back in the 1930s. It turns out the Air and Space Museum of the Smithsonian back in Washington, D.C., I went and checked this last Christmas, they've just changed their exhibit, completely absolving hydrogen of all guilt in that problem. I mean, there were hydrogen tanks on board, but the reason why that airship burned was because the fabric was coated with a highly incendiary mixture of chemicals that were set off by an electric discharge from an approaching storm. When the hydrogen tanks were reached by the flames, yeah, the hydrogen burned sharply upward, being lighter than air, killing no one. So, I mean, the moral of that story is don't paint the airship with your airship with rocket fuel. But so hydrogen has dangers. It has to be handled carefully. For one thing, in pipelines, it embrittles metal, and it's easier to leak out, so you need tighter seals. But we need codes and standards, and people are working on this. But the thing is, we're spending 0.2% of our annual national energy research budget on hydrogen. Meanwhile, 60% of it on so-called clean coal. And you know, nuclear and all these other big boondoggles. And it's just a matter, it's not a technical problem, really. I mean, there are technical problems that we need to finesse with hydrogen, but if where there's a will, there's a way. If we put our minds to it, we can get there soon. But unfortunately, we've got, I said this the other day, the oil boy network in control of our national budgets and everything, and we need to move them aside and move on with the future here of sky power. Now, here's a nice example. Look at this. You know where this is, right? This is down in Australia, Sydney Harbor. We need these things on San Francisco Bay or Chelan Lake. Lots of sun on Chelan Lake. This thing is powered by wind, which is actually uses these things as sails, and the sails are coated with photovoltaics, making some of the electricity for the boat. And right now they have a diesel backup, but they're going to replace it with a fuel cell backup. They've got a fleet of a few of these. It's called the Solar Sailor. I think you can go to solarsailor.com. You see all kinds of pictures and get the scoop on it. And here's the thing at NASA. Yeah, this is a great thing. Was there another one in the background? This is a great thing. This is the ultimate invention. This is a thing, it's a plane that has set the world altitude record for sustained flight. It's up around 100,000 feet. And it can stay up there for months at a time. An unpiloted vehicle for atmospheric research, surveillance, reconnaissance, aid for disasters and things like that. And what it has is the wings are coated with photovoltaics to make electricity during the daytime, and then it makes extra electricity, which electrolyzes water, making hydrogen, which then is stored, and at night, it stays up there, it keeps being powered by the hydrogen being run through a fuel cell. And what's the exhaust when the hydrogen's run through the fuel cell? Water, which then gets collected to be re-electrolyzed the next day with the next day's sunlight. And it just keeps going back and forth between water and hydrogen, water and hydrogen, water and hydrogen. And so the thing can just stay aloft for months. And no, it's not a perpetual motion machine, you know. I mean, you have the materials are being conserved, the hydrogen and the water, and you're storing them. And so this is a really neat thing. Let's see, what's that called? It's called the...
how big is it?
It's, well, maybe 100 feet. The wingspan is 100 feet, something like that.
And Helios prototype.
Yeah, Helios. And that's down at Dryden is where they, this is actually in Hawaii where they're doing some test flights of it. But, well, let's see. I think we're almost out of time. I don't know if I have any other good slides, but maybe we should just have a little bit of time for questions and discussion here.
The BMW hydrogen car, is that a commercially... is that a commercial product at this point?
Oh, the blue one that I showed you earlier?
Yeah.
Germany has done a lot of stuff on this stuff. The Germans, the U.S. has the best resource, for instance, for wind power, but you know who's doing the most about it? It's Germany and Spain. And, it's technology which, I mean, we've got the brain power in this country to be developing all this stuff, and we're not doing it. But that's not answering your question about cars. But, the fuel cell cars, I think, are going to be more better than the internal combustion engine cars.
Are they selling market now?
Yeah. There's a couple companies that are planning to do fuel cell cars within the next year. The first ones will just be leased as for fleets, for businesses, but eventually they'll become available to consumers probably within the next 5 years.
question, Jonathan?
The city of Atlanta, with all of its parking lots, raises the temperature in Atlanta 10 degrees compared to the countryside of Georgia.
Heat island.
What's the effect of photovoltaic cells on the atmospheric temperature above them? Are they bouncing heat like asphalt does?
Well, see, they absorb, okay, they're about 15% efficient, which doesn't sound very good, but I mean, you know, it's free energy coming in from the sun. They reflect a lot of light back just from the glass, such as those reflections you've been seeing from the solar panels on the satellites that I've been showing people at night. So a lot of the energy just gets reflected back, and that doesn't contribute to warming at all. A lot of the electricity, 15% of it or so, gets turned into electricity, and there is some heating below the panels, just locally, but it's not known to be a significant problem at all. That's an interesting question, though. I should look into that a little bit more and find out whether, if you had a whole city paved with photovoltaics, what would be the heat island effect?
Did that airplane take off from the ground, or was it
dropped? Yeah, it actually takes off from the ground, gets up to 100,000 feet over a number of hours, and it's going to stay there. Another question here?
Where do you get your, if you own a hydrogen cell vehicle at home, where do you get your hydrogen from to make it?
Well, now that's the thing. It's going to be sort of like you're going to have hydrogen delivered to your home unless you're going to make it in your backyard. So it'll be sort of like natural gas.
Currently, is there a source of getting hydrogen delivered to your house?
No. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Is the weak link is the hydrogen infrastructure. We're not even trying to work on that yet.
Is it very efficient? Like, you don't need a lot of hydrogen to do it, or is it a high volume?
Yeah, they're very efficient. Very efficient. And you can store hydrogen in a number of ways. You can compress it. You can do it cryogenically. There are cars right now that have cryogenic hydrogen tanks, which are, you know, way low, super low temperatures. But my favorite, and here's another investment for you, ENER, energy conversion devices. They make solar cells and the thin film photovoltaics for rooftops, but they also are working on metal hydrides, powders, to store hydrogen. And the powders act like a sponge. And like lithium hydride and other things like that, they will store the hydrogen, and then all you have to do is heat them up a little bit, and the hydrogen percolates out in a very slow, controlled, safe manner to provide fuel for a fuel cell car. So, yeah.
What happens if you get in an accident or, you know, some of that's
cool? Well, that's the good thing. There's no such thing as a hydrogen spill, as there are with gasoline and oil spills. And with gasoline, one of the reasons it's more dangerous than hydrogen is that you get these lingering vapors, and you get a spark or something, and poof, you got flames and explosions and all that. With hydrogen, it's lighter than air. When there's a leak, it's out of there in a hurry. So it's actually, in that respect, quite a bit safer. And they've also got new storage tanks that just are, nothing's going to do any damage. Yeah.
You've given out a lot of websites and company names. You don't have those on the list.
Well, check out that magazine over there. Actually, a lot of those stock symbols, I didn't know the stock symbols until I knew about the companies because I've invested in them, and Astro Power being the largest U.S. manufacturer of solar cells, for instance, APWR. But that magazine has an article near the front of it on, green investing or something, that Co-op America quarterly. It's sitting on the rack right over there right now. And that's a good, and it all, oh, another thing I want to tell you about that I just found out about, I'm overjoyed to find this out. I've been feeling really bad about having to pay $49 a year for my CSAA, California State Automobile Association, a California branch of the AAA. And basically, I never need their auto towing services, so basically I'm just paying them $50 for their junk mail magazine that comes about whatever. But turns out there's now, and also the AAA is a notoriously bad. They're a big lobbying arm of the auto industry. They oppose clean air regulations. They oppose mass transit. So guess what? There's now a greener alternative. It's called the Better World Travel Club or something like that, and it's betterworldclub.com. And you can pay a comparable amount and you get the insurance. See, the reason I'm stuck with AAA is that in order to have my AAA insurance, I have to join AAA, so I have to pay them the extra $50. But now this company will give you your insurance as well as the maps and towing services, and even they'll help you book an electric car at your destination city or a hybrid car. They'll help you find your eco-friendly motels and hotels and resorts. So it's betterworldclub.com, and check it out. It's in that magazine. I just found out about it the last few days. So I love that magazine.
Your website, John.
Oh, yeah. Well, Mary actually put together a website, sky-power.org. So you can check out our website, www.sky-power.org. There are parts of it that are outdated, like trips I led in the Sequoia National Park 2 summers ago or something, but there's a lot of good links and information and educational emphasis in there, and that'll be a good way to keep in touch. Oh, and by the way, since I'm leaving today, I got to tell you all who are staying, tonight at 10:32, there's going to be another one of those bright lights in the sky. It's just right over Martin's Ridge, about in the northeast at 10:32, and it's going to be a pretty bright one. And that'll be seen from here in the village or any place that you can see about 32 degrees up in the sky. It's going to be 10:32 at 32 degrees above in the northeast, and it's going to be, again, the sun at night reflecting off photovoltaic panels from the solar cells of the Iridium telecommunications satellite in the network. So, anyway. So I tell you, keep an eye on the sky and sky power to the people.